Throughout her career as a reporter, Amber Hunt has covered crime for news outlets like the Detroit Free Press, the USA Today Network, and the Cincinnati Inquirer. She was also the co-producer of the popular podcast Accused, about the unsolved murder of Elizabeth Andes. Over the years, she's interviewed and written about numerous gunshot victims and reported how the shootings took place, the conflicts that preceded them, and the legal consequences for those who pulled the trigger. Through the years, she was left with some lingering questions. What's life like for gunshot victims? How have they dealt with the trauma of being shot? To answer these questions, Hunt teamed up with Elizabeth Van Brocklin of the nonprofit news organization known as The Trace to create Aftermath, a podcast about gun violence survivors, which debuted in May and ran for 8 episodes. In the Aftermath podcast, Hunt and Van Brocklin traveled the country talking to gunshot survivors in an effort to understand their reality. Hello and welcome to Ethics Examined, an audio story produced by the Center for Journalism Ethics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. My name is Stephen Potter, and I'm a senior fellow with the Center. Recently, I spoke with Aftermath co-producer Amber Hunt about her work and the ethical considerations that went into producing a podcast that digs into the delicate, difficult topic of gun violence. Here's that conversation. So to get right into the Aftermath podcast, how did you come up with this idea, and what were some of your early conversations with editors like?
The first time I started to get this idea, I was reporting in Detroit, and I left there in 2010, so that gives you some idea of how long this has been in my mind. But at the time, we would write stories about survivors here and there, it was usually a one-off, and it's what, 20 inches, 40 if it's a Sunday front page, you know, so it's not a whole lot of space to really delve into it. But there was one story in particular that really, like, grabbed me, which was a Detroit police officer who had been shot 7 times and survived. And, you know, it's, you walk in and into the house to interview him, and it's a wonderful thing because he's alive. But then you realize, oh, he has a colostomy bag and he can't work anymore because he's got pins and needles in his feet all the time. And yeah, he lived, but nothing's the same. So when I left in 2010, it was for a fellowship at the University of Michigan, the Knight Wallace Fellowship. And that was one of the ideas I had. Like, you're basically told not to work for a year. It's like winning the lottery for a journalist. Mm-hmm. So you take classes and you just try and reinvigorate yourself. So one of the things I focused on was something that back then I was calling Beyond the Bullets. And I even mapped out like a website, but I never quite figured out how to get it off the ground, and it went to the back burner. And then I moved to the Dakotas and I worked for the AP. And then I came to Cincinnati to join the Inquirer, but I was doing consumer affairs for a couple of years. And then Accused came along and I realized, oh, podcast's the way to tell this story, because the voices, you know, and getting in it more in depth with these people and their experiences. And so I reached out to The Trace because I knew that they had I knew I wanted it to be nationwide, and they had more experience talking with people across the whole country, not just in, you know, the Cincinnati area. And we teamed up in trying to find the right mix of people, and that's how it was born.
In your building process, even before you began the reporting, did you guys have some ethics talks about Aftermath and how you'd go about it, and what was talked about there?
Oh, sure. We very specifically didn't want to get people involved who weren't ready to talk to us. That was our, like, number one concern. And so that was the big help that Elizabeth Van Brocklin brought to the table, because she would reach out to people that she knew through her networking. Some of them she had interviewed for different kinds of stories. And she would, like, lay out what we're hoping to do and are you ready for this? And you know, some people were not. They might have talked for other stories. But, you know, we sat with them sometimes up to 7 hours, just rehashing everything that they had gone through, like from childhood through the terrible incident, and then everything that's happened since connected to it. And that is pretty grueling and very invasive. And so we didn't want anybody to feel like, you know, they didn't know what they were getting themselves into. They weren't ready to talk in this kind of depth. And so that was the big thing she brought, was, you know, really sort of hand-holding people to make sure that they were ready for this. And we had some who weren't. We actually had one in Virginia who canceled on us the night before we were flying out because he said his family, turns out they weren't supportive of him talking. The person who had shot him is still at large. And those sort of a snitches end up in ditches kind of mentality among some of his family and friends. And so they were not in favor of him telling his story. So it was tricky. And then when you're sitting down talking to these people too, you know, you say, okay, only as much as you're comfortable with, you know, you don't have to go down that path. Although there wasn't a single time that we asked a question that they chose not to answer.
So how did you identify those you wanted to profile for this story or for the Aftermath podcast? And, you know, with the importance of accuracy in mind, how did you vet and kind of verify the stories and what the survivors were telling you?
Well, most of them had been in the news at some point, and so we could at least see some kind of consistency in their tale. There were only a couple whose original shooting didn't at least make the news. And we requested police reports and 911 calls and just things to make us feel comfortable that, you know, the story itself was accurate. Sometimes medical records, you know, to just enough. When it comes to, you know, somebody telling you how they feel, you can't fact check that. So that's sort of a gut thing. There wasn't a moment. I've got a really good bullshit detector. That doesn't mean that I can't be bamboozled by somebody for sure, but I never felt like anybody was embellishing. So that helped too. I mean, I've been doing this for 20 years and I've caught some people in some pretty big lies. And every time I cross-checked a fact, it came out clean. So I felt pretty comfortable that the people we ended up talking to were legitimate and just wanting to share their story for the same reasons we were wanting to tell them, which was to spread awareness about, you know, what happens. You hear all the time, you know, the shooting was not life-threatening and yay, they lived. But that's not the end of the story. It's horrifying sometimes. I mean, imagine not being able to lift your arm anymore to brush your hair. Yes, you're thankful to be alive, but that doesn't mean that your life isn't affected.
Were there any ethical issues that came up during reporting that you didn't prepare for or discuss, and how did you deal with them?
Let's see. Ethical issues while we were there? Not so much, actually. We Elizabeth did a lot of pre-interviewing, which is not my forte. I don't actually like to pre-interview because I want to have an honest conversation with somebody. And if I've had that conversation two or three times already, and then it feels scripted. Mm-hmm. So I don't do that much, but she did spend some time kind of checking with them, you know, looking at some facts, pulling some records and all of that stuff. So I think we felt pretty comfortable. There were a couple of instances where the culprit was still at large or we needed to decide, like, whether to name them. For example, there was a school shooting episode, and with the movement right now to not, the no notoriety movement, to not give attention to the culprits here, I decided, you know what, I'm not going to name this kid because you can Google it, you can find his name, this isn't his story, this is his victim's story. So there were things that we kind of hashed out along the way that we weren't necessarily expecting, in part because when we started reporting this, Vegas hadn't happened, Parkland hadn't happened, so things had already changed on that landscape, and we needed to roll with that.
So with this series and this topic, there seemed to be some inherent kind of ethical landmines. The topic of gun control is a big one. How did you and your partner, Van Brocklin, navigate that touchy topic?
It is touchy, and it was funny because even before the podcast came out, I started getting trolls online telling me I was a shill and, you know, this was propaganda and all this. just assuming that because we're telling the stories of the victims that we were encouraging people to support gun control. Well, you know, maybe you should think about that. Why is hearing the story of a survivor, why do you think that that would encourage people to think along those political lines? That's not my doing. That's just how it is. But I didn't want it to be political. So we actually made a point to try to steer clear because I care about politics, but that's not the point of these stories. And the mix of opinions with the people we interviewed pretty much reflected society's mix when you look at the polling, which is, you know, yeah, they support the Second Amendment. They'd like to see it become a little easier to take guns away from people who have a history of mental illness mixed with violence, you know, domestic violence. It'd be great if there were a way. So the only time the politics came up in the podcast was basically when it wasn't avoidable, because some of these people naturally became advocates because of their experience. So that is one of the ways that their experience shaped their futures. They might not have been, you know, gun control advocates had they not been shot. So that was never a focus of an episode, but sometimes it would have to be mentioned. You know, the very first episode, Clay Lasher Summers, she heads up a gun control group in Vermont, you know. So by the time 8 came out, I was like, you know what? We're getting accused of being political anyway. I'm just going to address that, especially now that Parkland's happened and stuff. So you hear, you know, Emma Gonzalez and the other students' voices in that one because it is the school shooting episode. And things did change, you know, at least in terms of what kind of conversation people were having. And that's not me trying to sway things. That's just what the news is.
Another important ethical concern, I think, in a series like this is not wanting to do further harm to the victims or survivors that you're talking to by having them kind of relive the experience. How did you, what steps did you take with that in mind?
The first one was reaching out to the trace again. I mentioned to you earlier the Detroit cop who had been shot 7 times. He was the first person I reached out to when I started to report this. And he replied to me, you know, thank you, but that's not a part of my life anymore. And that blew me away because, of course, it is. He's a motivational speaker now. He's had to deal with the ramifications of this. But clearly, he wasn't wanting to talk about it. You know, it wasn't something he wanted to relive. So that's when I realized, like, okay, so even people, the story I'd written about him before was about these trials he was facing. So he had at some point been comfortable talking about it. Now he wasn't. I needed to be careful not to push people who weren't ready. So the trace part was first on that. I didn't want to be cold calling people saying, hey, I read about you in the newspaper and I know you were shot. You want to tell me all about it? Like, that's terrible. That's incredibly, you know, inconsiderate. So that was number one. And number two was making a point throughout the interview to say again and again, you know, if you don't want to go down this path, that's totally fine. Only as much as you're comfortable. Do you need a break? Do you want some water? All of that stuff. We were very, very mindful that this was potentially re-traumatizing. And that was like a mantra of both of ours. We don't want to re-traumatize. So we're going to, you know, we're going to be as respectful as humanly possible.
I haven't seen the numbers for Aftermath yet, but I mean, your Accused podcast did very well. And, you know, one thing that can happen with these news reports is that they get really popular and the victims or survivors kind of become celebrities of a sort, or people may recognize them on the street and ask them questions that may cause them to kind of relive the trauma and the experience again. Did you go back and warn anyone, any of your the survivors that you spoke to, that this might happen, or did you talk about that with them?
Yeah. Actually, that was part of our initial talk. We talked about it again during the interview. And then once I started to get the, you know, you're trying to promote propaganda stuff online, I was like, okay, like, I can handle this, but I don't want, you know, Clay and you know, Hallie and all these people who I'd obviously come to care about, I don't want them to feel blindsided. So I would compose like an email and say, okay, be ready for this. Just brace yourself. Don't read the comments. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's the mantra. I am terrible at following myself. Don't read the comments. But for the most part, though, I didn't see them getting anything, at least not any more than they already did. Like, the people who were active in gun control, period, they already got stuff. But the other ones, they really didn't seem to bear the brunt of it. So that was mostly just me.
So lastly, with ethics in mind, what kind of advice would you give young reporters or other journalists who are going to be taking on a project like Aftermath?
To follow your compass first, to ask your editor if you're unsure, because, you know, a lot of the old time reporters, the veterans, have been kind of pushed out through buyouts and newsroom decimation in general. So you don't have the easy access to, you know, a colleague to just say, hey, is this okay? Or have you dealt with this before? So you have to seek it out more. Find somebody on Twitter, send them a direct message, you know, find a veteran there. And don't be afraid. Like, it's okay that you haven't faced this dilemma before and that you want to ask for input. But there is this line you walk between, you know, you need to provide all the information that is important to tell the story, that's important for public safety. You don't want to hold anything back just because police ask you to. But if you can ask yourself whether this tidbit that they desperately don't want out is actually adding something to your story, if the answer is no, then consider, you know, okay, my gut is telling me I don't need to include it. I know that it doesn't add to my story. Maybe I should leave that out. And that's okay. That doesn't make you, you know, an arm of the man. It just means that you are trying to balance ethics and transparency, and that's okay.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much for your time today, Amber. For those listening at home, tell us where they can find the Aftermath podcast.
We're everywhere that you listen to podcasts, so iTunes, Stitcher, all that stuff. You can find us, the Cincinnati Inquirer is my boss. Mm-hmm. So you can find us at cincinnati.com/aftermathpod. And we're on Twitter and Facebook and all that stuff.
This has been Ethics Examined, production of the Center for Journalism Ethics. My name is Stephen Potter. Thank you for listening.